I'm David Mitra, in case none of you have met me before. If you have met me before, you might be seeing a new David Mitra. Almost hairless. I've had my hair cut. I had a long ponytail. I hadn't had a haircut for, 2.5 years or so? It saves a lot of money. It's very useful. But gets a bit in the way eventually, and of course, it started falling out now, so I thought we'd better get rid of it. My eyebrows are falling out too, by the way, so a few weeks' time you might see much, much less hair on me yet. I'd like to begin by saying I'm really delighted to be here. I love teaching this class. I'd happily teach this class every Monday night, but that's sheer greed. One has to make allowances for other people's desire to communicate the Dharma as well. I'm particularly happy to speak on this occasion for a number of reasons. But I'm always happy partly because it's the most exciting time of my day. You know, I've got a vague idea about what I'm going to say, and the rest is in the lap of the gods. It's always very exciting when you don't quite know what you're going to say. I have a vague plan, more than a vague plan. I've got a definite plan, and I will try to stick by it. But I sometimes get carried away in all sorts of little tangents, and you're going to have to bear with me this evening, because that might happen again. What I'm supposed to be talking to you about is what's called the seven bodhiyangas, or the seven factors of enlightenment, which sounds rather heavy duty, doesn't it? And actually it's a lot to cram in on just one evening, so I'm not even going to try to do that. But I'm not going to neglect my duty entirely. I'm a very dutiful man. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the seven factors of enlightenment, give you a broad idea of what their significance is, and then talk to you about what I really want to talk to you about. But it will have relevance to the seven factors of enlightenment, I promise. Okay? So, the seven factors of enlightenment is one of the most ancient teachings in the Buddhist tradition. It's very, very widely known. And if you like, it's a kind of formulation of the path. There are many such formulations of the path in Buddhist tradition, but this is it's a particularly popular one. It's a particularly well-known formulation. So essentially what that means is, if you like, the stages through which we gradually ascend the spiritual path, to use that particular metaphor. And the first of these factors of enlightenment, the first of these stages, if you like, is something you should all be very, very familiar with by now. It's called mindfulness. Mindfulness is, of course, a very, very important aspect of Buddhist teaching. It's even becoming important in the secular world right now. But it's been with Buddhism right from the outset. The Buddha's final words to his disciples were, "With mindfulness strive." So mindfulness is clearly very, very important. And so in this particular formulation of the practice, that's where the path starts. It starts with mindfulness, just simply becoming more aware. That's the first stage. You've heard a lot about that. I'm not going to teach very much about mindfulness this evening. Perhaps you'll be relieved to hear. Second stage is the investigation of mental states. What this essentially means is learning to distinguish between what we call skillful and unskillful mental states. Because our mental states determine the way that we act, react, or behave in the external world. So it's very, very important to know what it is that's motivating us and whether that motivation is skillful or unskillful. And of course, within Buddhist tradition, this is the whole basis of ethics. We want to try to learn more and more to act skillfully and to restrain from our inclinations to act unskillfully. So this really is looking at pointing to the whole ethical dimension of Buddhist practice. Again, I imagine quite a few of you are familiar with this. I'm not going to say anything about that this evening, beyond what I've already said. Third stage is virya. Vigor, energy. I've spoken rather a lot about energy. It's one of my favourite topics. I'm going to tell you a lot more about that this evening. That's really what I'm going to talk about, because I think I need to sort of select something out of these seven factors. I can't really do justice to all seven in one evening. But even to do justice to virya in one evening is difficult. I've given a whole course of talks on virya in the past in Birmingham. I think I gave 7 talks on it. And each week I found something new to explore. So it's a huge topic in itself. And so I decided to narrow my field of exploration down even further. I'm not going to say what that is just yet. I'm going to keep you in suspense as we move on to the next stage of the seven factors of enlightenment, which is rapture. Just joy, bliss. The eruption of rapture that arises sometimes when you're meditating, sometimes as a consequence of Buddhist practice, quite spontaneously, when you're out on a walk somewhere, you see something truly beautiful which moves you. Sort of experience which I'm sure many, many of us all have had. And you get this sudden sort of eruption of joy. I feel that particularly keenly at the moment, which perhaps I'll explore a little bit later. So that's rapture. After rapture comes tranquility, when things kind of settle down, not in a negative sense, but in the sense of there's just more sort of mental equilibrium, if you like. And that leads to the next stage, the fifth stage, which is a big one, the sixth stage, which is concentration or samadhi. Again, you've heard a lot of talks about this, I'm sure, from Matthew Bandhu and the rest of us. It's not my topic for this evening. Finally, concentration. That concentration leads to equanimity at the highest level, the very highest level. And with this particular teaching of the seven factors of enlightenment, Peksha or Peka, the Pali and Sanskrit word for what we generally translate as equanimity, represents the highest stage of the path. In other words, it's equivalent at the highest level to enlightenment. Now, I might have just a little bit to say about that right at the end of my talk, if I remember. I've got an old man's brain, you see. There's no guarantee where this talk's going to go. I may get there, I may not. But let me come back to energy and the specific aspect or approach to the development of energy that I'm going to try to explore with you this evening. First of all, just a few general points. Energy, of course, is very, very important if you wish to pursue a spiritual life. It's very important if you want to pursue anything. Got no energy, you can't do anything. So it's a vital human quality. But, of course, we have to imbue that with some kind of spiritual significance. And within Buddhist tradition, we do that by defining energy, really, as energy which is in the pursuit of the good. So it's important to bear that rider in mind when you hear whatever I have to say in a few moments about energy. But again, before I plunge quite into what I'm really going to tell you about, I was just very struck before the class started. Listen, I just was very fortunate to catch that wonderful story by Sangamani about the Japanese monster she met on the door. And I'll tell you what struck me about it was that the way I perceived it, and I think this really gives you a clue about what I want to talk about. This is something which is very much based in my own experience and practice, something which I consciously try to do, which I think probably for a long time unconsciously I was doing, but it's just become so much more consciously, especially in the last few years. And it seems to me that as Sangamani was standing on that doorstep, confronted by this Japanese-like monster, what she was doing was she was simply open to new experience. That was her attitude, as she described it. That's how it struck me, anyway. I don't know whether Sangamani would agree with that. Yeah, she does. Oh, that's most fortunate. It would have been embarrassing that she said no. But I think that this is a vital spiritual quality, to be open to new experience. There are a number of aspects of this which I'll come on to throughout the next few minutes. I do need to sort of make it quite clear what I mean by that, though. And I think it's perhaps best illustrated by a few anecdotes from my own experience to sort of try to give you a clearer understanding of what I mean by that. I should explain that by bringing this particular take to energy as I'm going to do this evening, I am departing somewhat from traditional discourse. I think that what I'm saying is very much in the spirit of traditional discourse, but you won't find anywhere, as far as I'm aware, an account of being open to new experience. It's very much my expression. It's something which came to me very, very strongly about 15 years ago, when I realised that it was something that I needed to address at that time. So that came about because I was living in a community, a men's community, in Birmingham at the time. And I have lived in men's communities most of my life. I live in one now, upstairs, above this centre, Sukhavati. And they've been very, very important to me. I'm a man of a monkish disposition. There are not many of us around in Tree Ratna, but I'm one of them. And I've led a single life most of my life, and I've valued that. But if you're a single man like I am, you do need supportive conditions in order to sort of help you sustain and maintain that, which is one of the reasons why I value living in a men's single-sex community. And I'm sure that there are plenty of women who would say the same about their women's communities. Anyway, I really, really do value men's communities, but like all things in life, sometimes they can go a bit kind of pear-shaped. And I hope none of my former community members in Birmingham are going to be offended by this, but I felt that at the time I was living there, towards the end of my time there, that things had not exactly gone pear-shaped, but I could see tendencies in some of my peers, some of my, let's say, contemporaries as order members. And I saw these as warning signs for me. We were getting old. We were getting old together. And, you know, we were in our... by the time this happened, we were actually in our late 50s, early 60s probably, but... maybe late 50s for me. Or even mid-50s, I can't remember. I noticed that there was an increasing tendency, particularly with two of them, to complain. To moan. Wish things were different from how they were. And I think, had they not been careful, and I sincerely hope this hasn't subsequently happened, they would have been in great danger of becoming grumpy old men. Now, I have a fear of grumpy old men. I do not want to become a grumpy old man. It seems to me that grumpy old men are dead. They are spiritually dead. And that's far worse, it seems to me, than being physically dead. I'd rather be dead than become a grumpy old man. And so I've made considerable efforts not to become a grumpy old man. I could see the potential in myself, that is. I'm not claiming I was pure. I could see the potential there. And I decided that from that point onwards, I was not going to complain about anything. I was not going to give in to any kind of gentle little moan or complaint, and just take what was there. It was my immediate reality. Why complain about it? But there's a deeper question which came to my mind, and that was, how does this happen? Why is it that so many people, as they get older, get grumpy? And I'm not just talking about men. Women, too, are subject to this kind of syndrome, I have noticed. I had an elderly mother to look after for a while, and she certainly fell into this particular trap. Understandable, she was in her late 80s by that stage of her life. She's a very good woman, actually, but, you know, boy, it was difficult sometimes to and sort of countenance some of the complainings that went on. So I made a decision that I must never fall into complaint again. But yes, I wanted to find out. Well, why does this happen as people get older? And this is what occurred to me. It seems to me that when you're young, you don't have much experience. you're open to new experience. In fact, you have to be, because that's how you learn. That's how you learn where your life is leading. That's how you learn what you want to do. And that's a very positive and very necessary thing. But it does have its... Well, there comes a point, it seems to me, where things begin to settle down. And I think that for most people, it begins as early as 25. Now, what I mean by this is that you've got, by the time you're 25, you're not a hugely experienced human being, but you've got some experience. You've gathered a little bit of experience. Perhaps before that, you didn't have very much. It was still in process of formation. But then suddenly, it begins just a little bit to crystallize. It's crystals which form arthritic joints, I believe. Old age is beginning to set in at 25. At least the seeds of it are there. So you realize, what you learn is that certain things work for you. You like to do certain things. You think, well, you become familiar with things, basically. And you like... We slowly work ourselves into a mindset. This is what works. This is what works for me. And I want to keep on working like that for me. I'm not saying this is conscious, and maybe I'm just exposing my own inner workings here, but I think that's what happened to me. And so you start working with what, broadly speaking, amounts to your dislikes. With dislikes and likes and dislikes. Likes are a reflection of greed. Dislikes a reflection of aversion. We know we don't like certain kinds of experience. We know we do like certain other kinds of experience. Those experiences lead to pleasant experience. The other kind lead to unpleasant experience. We don't want those. We want the nice kind of experiences. Of course, some of these nice kind of experiences are not always skillful, but that's a whole other discourse. But anyway, fundamentally, this is what we're talking about. I think that we begin to learn what we like and what we don't like. We begin to form patterns in our lives. The things that work for us, we want to protect them. We want to keep them. We're familiar with them. And this pattern continues, begins to solidify by your mid-30s. By your mid-40s, rigor mortis is beginning to set in. By the time you're in your mid-50s, it's getting really difficult to stick with your likes, because things are changing. The world's changing. Things ain't what they used to be. And not only that, your body's changing. I mean, of course, your body's changing all the time anyway, but by the time you reach your mid-50s, you're beginning to get a good collection of minor ailments. And boy, we can dwell on those. And boy, we can complain about them and let people know that we have them. I've got a whole host of them. I'm not going to bore you with them. But they're a challenge. They're a challenge to our mental equilibrium. They're a challenge to our emotional positivity. They're a challenge to our capacity for avoiding distraction. These kind of things can become awfully distracting. They can, for some people, especially outside any kind of spiritual context, they can become a major preoccupation, which is a great tragedy, really. But I think they can creep into a spiritual life too, and we've really got to watch that. I think that's what begins to happen as you get older. You get fixed in your ways, and you get, you sort of start to cramp yourself. That means you cramp your energy. The more we indulge in these kind of things, no matter how justified in a sense they might be, or understandable at least, I don't think they're really ever justified, but it's certainly understandable, it ultimately limits us, and it limits our energies in a number of ways. I mean, for example, if you start complaining, for a start, that's a negative emotion. It springs from a negative emotion, and negative emotions always drain our energy. So they're best avoided. No matter how justified we might think they are, they limit us. They limit our capacity. Now, I'm sorry this is all a little bit dark. I want to move on to something much lighter straight away, by way of contrast. Around about the time at which I was talking, when I became aware of my potential grumpiness. I was very fortunate because, for many years, when I was the overall Mitch convener, a function that no longer exists, I used to travel to India every year. I used to teach there. And I never liked going to begin with. In fact, I hated it. But I had to do it because I'm a dutiful man. And so I did my duty in India. And gradually, almost grudgingly, frankly, I learned to like it. I didn't like it all because sometimes it's pretty challenging in India. It was a place where my normal comfort levels are not met. They never can be met in India, especially in our movement over there, where things are pretty basic. But it has other compensating factors. Now, at the time of which I'm speaking, I hadn't been to India for a few years. I don't know, maybe 4 years. I no longer had any legitimate excuse to go, but I did miss it. And I might also add, this is also pertinent, I didn't have the finances to get me there. My dear friend Subhuti had a quick word with me one day. He said, look, David Mitch, why don't you go back to India? I said, well, I do. He said, just go and see what you find. And I'm sure there's something that you can really give there. And he suggested that I go to Nagaloka, have a look at Nagaloka, and see if I could do anything useful there. So I thought, okay, well, why not? So I went to Nagaloka, where we, as many of you will know, we have a course, an 8-month Dharma course for young Dalits. That is to say, young people who come from the untouchable community or ex-untouchable community from all over India. And the age of these students is roughly, it varies sort of between 17 and 25. And the vast majority of them are between the age of 18 and 22. And what struck me immediately on that first visit was just how, their youthful energy, their vitality, it really struck me very forcibly. And It made me realise just how much I had lost contact with that, and that's just how badly, as an ageing man, I need to recontact that. And my work at Nagaloka over several years really helped me to do that. Because when you're young, you've got the whole of your life ahead of you. And that usually means most young people at least, certainly in India, certainly at Nagaloka, are pretty optimistic about their prospects, even though they come from not exactly enviable backgrounds, and I found that quite admirable. But it also stirred me. They had this wonderful optimism, which I shared with them, which I entered into the spirit of that. It revitalized me, it rejuvenated me, and it certainly made me realize that I must no longer live with old men. Because I think if you have too many old people together, they have a deadening effect upon one another. And I'm not excluding myself from that. But if you have a good mix of ages, then there's a wonderful sort of mutual giving which can take place. Old people, hopefully, have much experience to give younger people. But younger people have their vitality, their optimism, their openness to new experience to exchange for that. And I took full advantage of those students. I exploited them mercilessly. And I benefited enormously. I hope they benefited from me too. I think they actually did. It was a mutual love affair, really. And I miss the fact that the last 2 years I've not been able to go for reasons beyond my control. It's not that I didn't want to go. I very much wanted to. But things just didn't work out. They may not work out again this year. Unfortunately, we have to wait and see. But so that's my second story about being open to new experience. And now I'm going to come on to the latest, because this has been crucial for me. The reason I've had my hair cut is because it started falling out. The reason it started falling out is because I'm currently undergoing chemotherapy. And that's what happens when you undergo chemotherapy. Your hair falls out, your eyebrows fall out, your eyelashes fall out. My beard stopped growing. I haven't shaved for a week, would you believe it? It stopped growing. So these are all minor, acceptable side effects to chemotherapy. There are others which are much, much less pleasant. And I actually came here sort of from the chemo ward today. I was in chemo today, having my second of 6 chemotherapy infusions, which I have every 6 weeks now. So let me go back a bit. And I think it was about the beginning of November. I'd suspected it for a while, actually, but my GP, after examining me, told me, very cautiously, she said, I'm going to refer you for suspected prostate cancer. And I'm going to make an urgent appointment for you at Bart's. So immediately, of course, that told me she was convinced that's what it was. And she was right. You know, went through the various tests and scans and whatever. And I was diagnosed with what's called locally advanced prostate cancer. And so that's been the reality that I've had to confront for the last 3-4 months. And it's been very, very interesting and very, very invigorating. I think, well, I know I'm not alone in this kind of experience. Here I was facing a new challenge, a new experience. What was my response going to be? How I was going to deal with this? Well, when she told me, and I was convinced that she was convinced that this is what the problem was, and it must have been fairly serious, otherwise they wouldn't have given me an urgent appointment, I went for a walk around Victoria Park, and I mulled it all over, and I reflected about it. And as I did that, I felt a gradual arising of energy. I knew that here was a new challenge for me, a new experience to welcome, not to push away, not even just to tolerate. I had to welcome it, to benefit from it fully. So how did I come to that conclusion? Well, fortunately for me, one of my reflections on my previous solitary retreat, which was, I think it was in May last year, when things went horribly wrong, as they seemed to frequently do on my solitary retreats, not in terms of my mental equilibrium, but in terms of my body. The last few retreats have been very, very difficult for me because I have chronic back pain. And I find it very difficult to sit and meditate in a chair. I do my morning meditation, no problem usually, but to do the kind of intensive meditation I'd intended to do on both my last two short solitary retreats of 1 month, I just couldn't do it. And I had to find a way of making the most of that situation. On the first of those retreats, it was just, okay, this is not what you want. It's an adverse situation. Make the most of your adversity. That's been pretty much an aspect of Buddhist teaching I picked up in the very, very early days of my practice, and I've tried to practice that most of my Buddhist life. But on this second round, this second time when I was having such bad problems, I decided that, well, that really wasn't good enough. And the reason for that was this. I'd been studying, as I love to do in solitude. Well, not exactly studying, but every night before going to bed, I'd read one of the songs of Milarepa. And he mentioned in one of the early songs, as he very often does, the myriad manifestations. That's to say, the myriad manifestations of mind. And what was really striking about this was that he was able to enjoy all the myriad manifestations of mind, whatever they were, including whether they were pleasant or unpleasant. And I realized, this is what I have to learn to do. I have to learn to welcome all the myriad manifestations of mind. So what I'm experiencing at the moment is simply that. They're simply manifestations of mind. Of course, yes, I know I've got a large, aggressive cancer in my nether regions. It should be curable. It might not be. It should be, but because it's localized. But I've got to work on that. It's a manifestation of mind, even though it's physical. Ultimately, from a Buddhist perspective, it's a manifestation of mind. The myriad manifestations of mind includes all our physical, our inner world, if you like, and everything we experience in the outer world. Together, they constitute the myriad manifestations of mind. I'm not going to go into this in any great detail. I'm just mentioning it again, because I've mentioned it before. This determined the attitude with which I suddenly found myself confronting the fact that I had a cancer, and an aggressive one at that. So it was a new experience, and I had to welcome it. And I did. And one of the things that I suppose I've slowly learned over my life is that the most important thing in life, it's not even life itself, it's the quality of your mental state, the state of your consciousness. So this forced me, this new experience, which I'd welcomed, forced me to look, well, to go even more deeply into that. And I realized, in a way I think that I hadn't quite realized before, that yes, the most important thing in life is equilibrium of mind. Several weeks later, when I was due to hear my final diagnosis confirmed, I was at Barts Hospital, and I saw another ward member, and he came up to me and we started talking, and I knew that he too had prostate cancer that, unfortunately for him, in his case, is terminal. And we started talking, and I don't know why I said this, I just did. I said, well, look, the most important thing is not death, but equilibrium of mind. And he's a bit taken aback by that, understandably. I don't know why I said it, it just came out. And then he just laughed and said, yeah. Equilibrium of mind is more important than death. Discuss. And we chuckled about it. I said, actually, what I really meant to say was that equilibrium of mind is more important than life. I've always known that. I've always thought that, really, ultimately. But the sort of situation, or the sort of personal crisis, if you like, that I find myself in now, has really brought that home to me in a much deeper way. And I've reflected a lot about it. And fortunately, so far, I've been able to maintain that. Whether I can maintain it throughout this whole process remains to be seen, of course. But there are many, many more challenges ahead of me yet. But that's one very, very positive thing that's come out of this for me. I'd like to mention a few more things, and then we'll see if you've got any questions, specifically about being open to new experience, because that's really what I'm trying to get across. In one of my walks in the park recently, it was one of those beautiful, clear blue January days, crisp and cold, but bright, and that wonderful, wonderful lateral light that you get at that kind of year, that time of year. And I was just walking around the pond, and there's kind of like a bar of shadow immediately above the pond. And above that, there's this beautiful light catching the trees behind on the island, the tops of the trees. And I was looking at that, just appreciating the quality of the light. A cormorant flew up out of the shadow, straight into the light. And the light, that beautiful lateral light, highlighted the sort of, the kind of rainbow sort of, you know, the rainbowy sort of quality of the blackness of the bird as it flew so gracefully by. And as that happened, the same moment, just below the cormorant, there flew out one of those beautiful, luminescent green parakeets, caught in this beautiful light at the same time. And so it's kind of crossed over. And it was such a moment of intense beauty. It really moved me very deeply. And I think I was moved all the more deeply by the sort of hanging atmosphere in my mind, if you like, of my own impermanence. I don't think I'd have experienced it with such intensity. I don't think I'd have seen the depth of the beauty so clearly without that. One last story, and I'll then shut up and we can see if you've got any questions. We don't have to talk about the cancer, by the way, you can't lie, but I'm more interested in principle in this whole idea of being open to new experience. I'm just using these as examples to try and illustrate what I mean. I was, a few days after I'd seen my GP in November, I was on my way to Vajrasana for a retreat, weekend retreat, being led by Sinhamas and Vijayasaki, and we were driving up on the Friday afternoon in the car together with Ruta and Brian, who I think is already gone, but there was the five of us in the car, and I was sort of lost in this reverie, trying to work out, well, where would I like to die? How would I like to die? I'd like to die in a remote place, quite naturally, on my own. I was in this kind of reverie about how I was going to die, which actually was quite enjoying. And then suddenly, Sinhamanas just turned to me and said, what do you think, David Mitra? What about older order members? And I hadn't been following their conversation. I didn't know what on earth they were talking about. What do I think about older order members? And I just said, well, I think older order members I've got to learn to become like ghosts. Now, I don't know why I said that. It just came out. From the spontaneity, the depths of my mind. Infinite creativity at the base of my mind. It just flew up. Older members, should just, you know, learn to become like ghosts. And they're all a bit taken aback. What? She just laughed, I think. And I thought about it for a moment. I said, I think that, you know, older order members like me, we sort of need to learn to just be in the background, be a felt, perhaps unseen presence in the background, exerting a positive influence. And I think that ever since I came back to the LBC, this is what I've been trying to do, actually. You may not have picked it up, you may not have noticed. But actually, there's not much opportunity for an old codger like me around this lot, this youthful lot. We've got such brilliant teachers here. But I decided that's what I am. That's what I'm trying to be. But I think that reflection definitely came out of the experience of learning that, you know, well, I might not have that much longer to live. I might, of course, but, you know, there's a possibility at least that my life could be cut short by this cancer. And I'm ready for that. I don't regret it. And I don't regret it because I've led a life which has been steeped in Dharma practice for close on 45 years. I have no regrets about what I've done with my life. I have every confidence in Sangharakshita's presentation of the Dharma. I know it works. I've seen it work for other people. It works for me. How far I've gone with it, how deeply I've gone into it, that's not for me to say. I really don't know. And I really don't care, just so long as I know that I'm moving forward. Just so long as I know I'm not settling down into comfort, into the comfort zones, into the familiar, into everything that we crave of that kind. And the tendency to do that as you get older can become quite irresistible. But I'm determined to resist that. Which is why I love going back to India. I really value that more than anything. Which is why going on a Karuna appeal will be so good for you. You're opening yourself up to new experience. You're learning to do that. It's a wonderful experience. I mean, I hadn't realised how wonderful it was until I heard Samuel Mahaney talking about it this evening. It's really quite terrific. Why didn't I do one when I was younger? Anyway, I didn't. Too old now, you know. But you get the drift, I hope. It's really important to keep that openness to new experience, the spirit of adventure. In one of his books, I remember Bhante talking about, I think he's writing about beneficial experience, one of the four Sangha Vastus. What the Bodhisattva has to try to communicate is the sheer adventure and creativity of the spiritual life. And I think that's the kind of spirit I'm trying to somehow bring to life by my own particular way of putting this, being open to new experience. And that means experiences that come to you which you wouldn't have chosen. I didn't want this cancer, it just came. It presented itself to me. But you can also seek new experiences for yourself of a positive kind, like, in a sense, I did when I went back to India and gave Navaloka a try, if you see what I mean. So it's kind of sort of like a passive dimension to it and an active dimension to it. I rest my case. The floor is yours. Yeah?
I was just going to say, obviously, I haven't got any of your experience and all of this kind of stuff, but I just find it quite hard to imagine. It takes a massive leap of imagination for me to imagine how you could welcome the diagnosis of cancer as being a new experience that you welcome.
Yeah.
I just think if that was myself, I would just be going into all kinds of catastrophic scenarios and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I can understand that. And to be quite honest, I've been a little bit surprised that I haven't. Not too surprised, but a little bit. I'm not saying it won't happen yet. I kind of would be surprised if it did, but I don't rule that. I certainly wouldn't be so foolish as to rule that out as a possibility. But I think you've got to remember, I've been practicing the Dharma nearly for 45 years, and it's not going to happen overnight, this kind of attitude or this kind of approach. I think that one of the problems that we're faced with, not in the world generally, but even within our own movement, is that People want fast results, quick results. People want insight, and they want insight now. It doesn't work like that, I'm afraid. And I mean, this is, I mean, the whole of Buddhist tradition and history shows this. There's a wonderful story from Chinese Buddhism that there was this huge controversy in early Chinese Buddhism about whether enlightenment was sudden or gradual. And, you know, it was so severe, the controversy, that it split into two schools, the Northern School and the Southern School. The Southern School is the Southern School, I believe. But Huineng, the sixth patriarch, sort of neatly sort of brought the two together and made the point that the realization is sudden, but the approach is gradual. We like the realization being sudden. We don't like the approach is gradual. But actually, that's what we need. And we have to be realistic about where we are now. I think I've managed to be realistic about where I was now at the outset of my career. Well, not for the first few weeks. I was an arrogant young so-and-so, rather full of myself. But I slowly learned. You know, I had a lot to learn. I must open myself up to the Dharma, which I gradually did. And then you've got to start practicing it. And it's something you have to be very, very patient with. It goes very much against the spirit of the times, for reasons that I don't need to explain. But I think you have to be patient. Okay, you can't imagine that now. If you keep practicing the Dharma for 30 or 40 years, it may become a reality for you. And I hope that it does. Yeah?
I just say, I really have. You know, you just kind of seem always very kind of confident and calm, and I kind of felt that energy. And you know, just when you were saying that, that's what you. Yeah, I thought, yeah. Now I really, since I've been coming here, I've been seeing you, and yeah.
But it doesn't come all at once, and that's a great lesson, really. Mm. You must be patient, but do also seek out new experience. Like going on retreat. I mean, I think going on retreat for the first time is a wonderful example of that. But learning also slowly to embrace the more difficult experiences of life and welcome them. It's a long journey, but it's a doable journey for all of you.
Yeah. How you stay open to.
I'm not sure I can explain, but I think let's reflecting on what that might mean for you might be a start. I think it's a long process of relaxation in a way. That's another way of looking at it. You relax more and more with the experience of life, which I think in a way is why. You become slowly enable yourself slowly to enjoy the more difficult experiences of life. I mean, I remember many years ago, I woke up one night, 2 a.m, with a terrible, terrible, terrible headache like I'd never experienced before in my life. It wasn't like an ordinary headache. It was just like my skull was splitting. And I sat up in bed. I thought, well, what am I going to do? Oh, maybe I should call a doctor. I thought, no. It's probably too late to call a doctor. I might be dying. If it's not fatal, I don't need to worry about it. And then I relaxed. And I found it fascinating. I'd never experienced such intense head pain in my life. I really did wonder whether I was dying. But I just let go of all those ideas and just stuck with the pain. And it sort of, in a strange sort of way, I began to enjoy it. Life's really weird. I had shingles coming on. Took 3 visits of doctors before they could diagnose it as shingles. Because it's an unusual place to get shingles, and it's the most painful place to get it. And my GP later told me shingles is one of the most painful illnesses you can have. And boy, it's painful in the head. And it goes all over your face and all over your head and your ears. Your ears do funny, bizarre things. Believe me, all sorts of strange sounds. But you can enjoy it because it's new experience. I think, although I didn't consciously have that attitude then, I think that's what I was doing. I was opening myself to new experience I hadn't invited, but which, in the end, I benefited from. And it gave me great confidence in the Dharma, because I knew that I couldn't have responded to that pain in that way had I not been practicing the Dharma for so long. But, you know, these things, I cannot emphasize too much, come gradually. And eventually, hopefully, there will be a sudden realization of something much, much vaster. But I'm not sure whether I've really answered your question, but I can't answer, in a way I can't answer it. You've got to somehow work out what it means. Just try to be open, let's say, to new experience, whatever, even especially the unpleasant one. It's very easy to be open to new pleasant experience. We like that. We'll even pursue that. It might not always be good for us. But to open yourself to new unpleasant experience, to really let it in and experience it fully, can be difficult. It's a challenge, and I think anything which is a challenge of that kind is worth pursuing. Like, I gradually learned to love going to India. I miss it if I can't go. I miss it terribly. But I used to hate going, and that's a transformation over many years. Yeah? Well, I mean, there's probably is a connection, but could you give me a bit more?
Just listening to you, those words come up for me. Just this sort of being open requires a kind of, seems to require a curiosity.
Well, I suppose it's a kind of I suppose it's a kind of desire to encounter the reality, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think that's what I think it means for me. But I think that's what it has to mean ultimately for all of us, something along those lines, because we're trying to face reality. We're trying to face reality in the first instance by facing up to our own immediate reality, whatever that might be, now, however unacceptable that might be. So that means, I think that's where I'd put it. It's a kind of curiosity. I think reflecting what I just said about the shingles episode for me, in a way, when I relaxed, perhaps it was curiosity that emerged. So, what was the other part? The other quality. Fear and fearlessness. Well, yeah, I think relaxation in the deeper levels means letting go of fear. I mean, fear is a big issue, as we know, but fear is probably the last defense of the ego. You know, fear can only arise in connection with an ego sense. It cannot arise without that. So if you can overcome, even momentarily, even temporarily, your ego sense, then the fear goes. There's nothing to lose. So does that deal with it? I mean, I think quite a few of you know, I've always been deeply inspired by the figure of Thich Quang Duc, the Vietnamese monk who immolated himself in downtown Saigon in 1963. And I think what he did was, I'm not going to go into the context, it was what he did was truly noble. But if you look at the pictures taken by the American photographer Malcolm Brown, he just sits there, unflinching. I've talked with one of the monks who's standing just 10 metres away from him as he burnt, and watched him for the whole 10, 15 minutes he was sitting upright. And he said he did not flinch. He did not move. He clearly was, it wasn't just courage, it was fearlessness. And that's one reason why I think that the Vietnamese Buddhists universally consider Quang Duc to have been a living bodhisattva, because they sense that fearlessness, and he inspired them with the courage to resist the Roman Catholic persecution that Buddhism was suffering in Vietnam at that time, which is really what it was all about. So I think that, yes, fearlessness is important, and fearlessness, of course, is a quality which, as Buddhists, we're encouraged to develop, and it's one of the qualities of the Bodhisattva. And so I've deliberately sought in my own, as my own sources of inspiration, figures who in some way or other have illustrated that. I would say it in a different way of Dr. Ambedkar. He's quite fearless in his own way. I mean, what he did was remarkable. I mean, it's just is astonishing what that man did. He's just such a great man. I think one of the greatest men of the last century. Not just one of the greatest men of India, but one of the greatest men of the last century. And I think he had a touch of that, at least. He certainly put his life on the line. Fortunately, he was never assassinated like his antagonist, Gandhi. But there's an element of that with him, and I take so he's another one of my personal heroes, if you like, and there are a few others like that. Because I want to develop that quality myself. So it's good if you can find figures that work for you. I'm not saying you have to choose the ones that I've chosen, but some figures who for you seem to have something of that kind of quality. It'll help you to get a feel for it. It will help you to begin to move towards it, to develop it. I hope this has not been too somber for you this evening. I do bang on rather a lot about this sort of thing, really. We've got a few more minutes. Yeah, Padmadara? Yeah.
It's partly about experiencing that emotion,
yeah.
That idea of the mind and the heart's complex response to that. Can you say anything about reflecting on how to walk that line without being too identified with the negativity?
Yeah.
It seems to be something about not repressing it.
Yeah.
It's kind of spiritual bypass and you don't get to it.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
No.
Or if you express it, if you experience it and in a sense indulge it or wallow in it,
yeah,
there are dangers that side.
That's right.
I'm just interested in if you can talk a little bit about walking another way.
I'm not sure how much I can say it's of help, but I think what I try to do is to experience it cleanly, if you see what I mean. The trick, of course, the big trick, is not to identify with it. But that's really, really difficult. We have this disastrous tendency to unthinkingly identify with our immediate experience. And when it's painful, it has the horrible sort of side effect of blanking out your imagination that this could ever come to an end. And that happens because you identify with it. If you don't identify with it, you'll see that it's impermanent, that it will pass. It cannot but pass, because nothing is permanent, either in the external world or the internal world. And if we, again, coming back to this wonderful virtue of patience, if we can only be patient with it, it will pass. But that seems to call for a certain amount of vision, and I would say confidence and faith in the Dharma. But learning that trick of not identifying is a lifetime's work. I mean, I think that I've reached a point in my life where I can not latch on to that now. But it probably took me the best part of 40 years to reach that. Maybe 35, maybe a bit less, I don't know. But it's been a gradual process. It's been a conscious process for me because I've seen the danger and I've not wanted to fall into it. I saw that danger for many, many years. And yet I kept tripping myself up. And it would take one of my friends, like Chisabuti, saying, come on, David Mitchell, this is not going to last. Get it in perspective. So I think that's probably the first thing you have to do, is try to get it in perspective. Try to be objective about it. And then it can help you to stop this disastrous tendency, put the brakes on it at least, of identifying with it. I think that's what I probably try to do. Maybe other people will work differently, but if that's any help.
Well, it's very helpful. Can I
Yeah, sure.
A little more on that? So yeah. How would you describe the difference between not identifying with it and alienation?
Right, okay. Well, I think the best way I can illustrate this is by giving you another little story from my own life. When I was in my mid-50s, mid-50s was a terrible time in life, believe me. 50s are well behind me, thank goodness. Not to be looked forward to. 60s are much better. You got more perspective. Anyway, I'm coming to the end of my 60s. My birthday is in just under 3 weeks, 69. Birthday cards addressed to LBC, please. Joke. April 2nd, in case you wouldn't know the date. It's a Sunday. Drat, no post. So I've lost track of the question by my silliness. Sorry, what am I trying to ask? Oh, alienation. Yeah. In my mid-50s, a terrible mid-50s, a number of things had gone wrong in my life. Fortunately for me, actually, they were very beneficial in the end, although I found it very difficult at the time. I'd lost my job. I'd been an overall Mitch convener for 20 years. Suddenly that post was scrapped. It was no longer needed. I won't go into details about that happened. It wasn't particularly pleasant. But I had no work. I'd worked for the movement for 30 years. I no longer had a profession. I didn't know any other way of supporting myself other than getting up on a stage and performing. That was my profession. I was an actor. I couldn't go back to that. I did try, actually, but, you know, it was useless. All my old contacts were either dead or retired. I couldn't get back into work. Padma Dara helped me out with a little bit of work at the BBC. Thank you very much. A bit of filming. But it was not a path for me. Padma Dara helped me to tie things over for me with a bit of money from the BBC. The mean little BBC. They're very mean with actors. But anyway, I appreciated what I got. But that was not a way forward for me. So I didn't know where my future lay. I was single. I was living in the men's community. It wasn't clear I could stay on in that community at that time. My whole world became very, very insecure. And so perhaps not surprisingly, I didn't know how I was going to support myself in the future. So not surprisingly, I would wake up occasionally, I stress only occasionally, but very occasionally, in the middle of the night thinking, who's going to look after me when I'm old? That sort of question. It's the sort of thing that torments middle-aged men. Perhaps middle-aged women too, I don't know. Probably. But that occasionally would pop up into my mind. And I knew that wasn't helpful. I had to get out of that frame of mind. Then one night, I wasn't asleep, but I felt this fear arising. And it came on very, very quickly and very, very intensely. And I could, momentarily, I could see that there was a collision about to take place. Fear. Who's going to look after me when I'm old? They were heading for each other. Rapidly. I sat up in bed. I said, no! In the middle of the night, I yelled out, it's just fear. Now, had those two things collided, I would have identified with them. Can you see how that would happen? Because the fear would have latched onto an object. And once a negative emotion of any kind actually latches onto an object, it's very, very difficult to separate the clean emotion from the object. And that's when the identification takes place. Now, on that occasion, I managed just to stop it in the nick of time and, you know, kept the idea apart from the emotion. And the fear subsided immediately. And I never worried again about who's going to look after me when I'm old. I couldn't give a monkey's now. You know, I mean, I'm almost 69. I have no mother, no father, no brother, no sister, no wife, no children, no partner, nothing. And I feel blessed. I've gone over time. We must stop.